Our final speaker this morning, Dr. Jen Ra, is the Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Florida, Jacksonville. She's going to speak on When We Fail, Approaches to Closing the Chronic Open Abdomen.
Good morning, and thank you. I have no disclosures. So we'll start with the case. 62-year-old male, status post exploratory laparotomy, sigmoidectomy, and end colostomy due to perforated diverticulitis. And despite all their creative measures of daily sequential tightening for 7 days, no further advances could be made, and his fascia is still about 15 centimeters apart. Oops, I'm going the wrong way. There you go. So the definition of a chronic open abdomen is the inability to close a fascia primarily 7 to 10 days post-op. And there's no uniformly accepted classification or grading system, although the World Society of Abdominal Compartment Syndrome did come up with their grading system, which makes sense. Grade 1A is a clean open abdomen. Grade 1B is a contaminated one. Grade 2A is a clean open abdomen with adherence of the bowel to the abdominal wall. Grade 2B is a contaminated open abdomen with adherence. And grade 3 is an open abdomen with a fistula, and 4 is a frozen abdomen. So we all know the complications. These are some of the complications. The patients are in a persistent catabolic state. There's obviously abdominal fluid loss, fistula formation, which is a dreaded complication, abscess formation, and of course the incisional hernia, and then increased ICU length of stay as well as hospital length of stay, and increase in vent days. But for our patients, this impacts our quality of life. So because when you lose the anterior abdominal wall, it creates difficulties with basic urination and bowel function, deep coughing and respirations, and even their posture. So we really want to try to get these closed. So the closure techniques are skin-only closures. There's a negative pressure dressings with eventual granulation and split-thickness skin grafting. There's bridging techniques with mesh and the component separation with or without mesh. So basically with skin closure techniques, it's basically creating a subcutaneous flap and then closing it midline, whether you use staples or sutures. It does provide coverage. However, it does not manage abdominal fluid very well. And when you're making flaps, you can also cause skin necrosis. And if that fails, you're going to have an evisceration and dehiscence of that wound. And the SSI rates are not insignificant in skin closure only options. And because there's more superior options available, it is the least favorable of the closure options. So here's a couple of examples of the two main vacuum dressings. One is a towel-based, the Barker's, and then sponge-based, which VAC and KCI both provide. They're both the more common ones we use. In our institution, we use the Apthera wound VAC. The great thing about the negative pressure dressing, it helps minimize a loss of domain, and the pressures are usually set at minus 125. You can drop that lower to 75 or 50 if there's concerns of bleeding on the abdominal wall. You definitely want to avoid direct towel and sponge placements on the viscera, so you really need to find a non-adherent, a non-absorbable perforated layer between the viscera and the sponge or the towel. The sponge-based systems are more effective than the towel-based systems for managing abdominal fluid, and it does provide a more uniform suction. But you know, these brands of sponge dressings are usually a bit more expensive than the towel systems. So what then you allow is the granulation tissue to form. Usually the granulation tissue grows up to the level of the skin. And once the granulation is optimal, then you can place a split-thickness skin graft over the top. But the patient will have an incisional hernia and will need a definitive repair once they are able to tolerate it. So here's an example of a patient whose granulation tissue has grown up to the skin. It's nice and healthy. And this patient has a couple of fistulas. And here is the picture of this mesh skin graft over the top, excluding the two fistulas. And so you want to wait a good 6 to 12 months until the skin sort of lifts away from the bowel. And make sure when you do the incisional hernia repair, you plan ahead. It's going to be an all-day case with lots of adhesions. And it's going to be even more difficult if you have fistulas or a stoma that you have to take down as well. And it's important to also get either a partner that does these frequently or a consultant like a plastic surgeon if you run into trouble during the case. So the third type is the bridging techniques with mesh, and basically what that is interposition of mesh between the fascial edges. The first one is an example of a polypropylene mesh, the second is a PTFE, and the third is a biologic mesh. Just kind of going over the mesh types. So the biologic, they're the human, porcine, and feline dermis. It's a decellularized collagen matrix. They are expensive, and they do tend to become lax over time, so to be aware of that. And they do degrade completely over time. There's a newer biosynthetics. They're basically a bioabsorbable layer over a synthetic core. There's not a lot of data about its use in contaminated or infected fields. It can be placed on bowel because of the bio layer. And it can be used as a bridge in a contaminated environment. And once it fully incorporates, it can possibly avoid an incisional hernia in these patients. The last type is a synthetic. There's two main varieties, the non-absorbable and the absorbable. The non-absorbable is a polypropylene, PTFE, and polyester. You do want to avoid placing these in contaminated wounds for infection rates, as well as avoiding laying this directly on the viscera. The absorbable types are the Vicryl and the Phasic or the Bio-A. The newer types tend to degrade a bit longer, so 6 months versus a 3 to 6 months with a Vicryl. The newer types allow tissue ingrowth and incorporation of native tissues, but they are also more expensive. So there's some studies that are out there that recommend certain mesh placement techniques. Suture fixation may have less contraction than tacks. Using a permanent suture in securing biologic mesh to reduce recurrence rates, and to make sure you cover bowel with before placing mesh, unless you use a certain type of mesh that can be placed directly over the viscera, and then avoiding large wrinkles during placement. So the last type is component separation. There are many, many different techniques, but classically, there's the anterior and posterior approach. The anterior approach is done more commonly. They can be done open or lap-assisted, and then choosing the type will depend on your experience than anything else. It's not recommended at the time of the initial chronic open abdomen because most likely the patient is still in a catabolic state from the primary insult. It's a very extensive procedure with its own risks. And once you've violated the tissue planes, you cannot use it again. So it's really important to use it sparingly. The relative contraindication of doing a component separation is in contaminated or infected fields. Mesh is recommended in both types, although the type of mesh is still debated. You do want an overlap of 3 to 5 centimeters to account for a contraction. And the mesh location may be important. So the sublay placement is basically between the rectus and the posterior fascia, and then the underlay is underneath all the abdominal wall components. But there's some studies suggest that it's really the surgeon's experience with mesh placement that's most important. So here's an illustration of the classic anterior component separation. And basically what you want to do is divide the external oblique aponeurosis all the way down its length. And that should give you about 6 centimeters on each side, so 12 centimeter of coverage if you do it bilaterally. And then if you need a few more centimeters, you can divide the posterior rectus sheath all the way down its length. And that should give you about 2 to 4 centimeters on each side, so a total of 20. When you're dissecting the external oblique off the internal oblique, you want to make sure you avoid damaging the neurovascular bundles because that can make your flap ischemic. But it can give you about, again, 20 centimeters of coverage. Oh, actually, one more thing. When placing mesh, the underlay placement is important. The posterior component separation, what you want to do is once you go through the midline, you want to separate the posterior sheath and then divide the transverse abdominis muscle and then close the posterior fascia and then place a sublay of mesh. And that's, the type is up to you. And then securing that to the abdominal wall and then closing the midline primarily. So compensatory operation outcomes, recurrence rates are fairly high, 20% without mesh and 10% with. The SSI rates can be up to 40%, so it's not benign. And those higher rates are in the patients are at higher risk, which are the morbidly obese patients. Seroma hematomas can occur in less than 2%, and skin necrosis less than 1%. And there's not a lot of evidence, strong evidence, to recommend one type over the other because there's so many variations of the procedure, and then the heterogeneity of the patient population, and of course the many mesh varieties that are out there currently. Here's some adjuncts if you are still concerned with finding tissue coverage. So some places use botulinum toxin preoperatively to the abdominal wall to cause the component relaxation. In Europe, they use progressive pneumoperitoneum, or so injection of air, room air, or CO2 via needle catheter placement, or an actual insertion of a catheter, and insufflating to about 15 millimeters of mercury, or until the patient becomes uncomfortable. It's not really been well adopted here in the States. You can also consider using myocutaneous pedicle or free flaps, or tissue expander placement. This is mostly described in the pediatric literature, but you can place these subfascially and gradually insufflate that. So going back to the case, the 62-year-old male with an X-lap for perforated diverticulitis, in this patient, it's probably either best to use a negative pressure dressing to allow granulation tissue formation and a split thickness skin graft, or using an absorbable mesh interposition and then a wound vac for temporary closure until they recover from their primary insult. So in summary, several types of closure are available for the chronic open abdomen. The closure type will depend on the patient's overall condition, the contamination or grade of the wound, and the surgeon's experience. Choosing the mesh type is important, and understanding which is best with the situation at hand. And then plan for a definitive hernia repair once the patient is optimized nutritionally and physically, and plan for a very long case and have additional support if the case becomes more complicated. Thank you.
There's really only one rule that the college gives all the moderators for each session. It's don't go over time. And I want to high five and fist bump the entire panel for not going over time. You guys did a fantastic job. Thank you. So now we have our allotted 15 minutes, which we planned on for commentary from the audience and panel discussion. If anyone has any questions.
I'll start with a question.
Oh, Clay.
Dr. Smith.
Dr. Berlew.
how do you do DPR? Where do you place your catheters? How long do you instill it? What type of closure? Like, give me some of the specifics on how you do it. And is there anyone in whom you would not do it? A patient with, and I give myself away because we've talked about liver injuries, pancreas injuries, you know, how do you really employ it at your institution? And is it for all trauma and general surgery damage control, or just trauma?
So we do it in all trauma and damage control surgery for general surgery. What I'll say is we place a single drain. We place it very lateral, and typically in the left upper quadrant, it keeps it away from most of the other, and I don't have to worry about a nurse putting tube feeding through it if I put it very lateral. We would take that drain, we would actually place it along the base of the mesentery, let the bowel fall on top of it, and then we continuously lavage it to a pump. We had started actually very complex. We were trying to do cc's per kilogram, and that's great and all, but it's not that scientific. You basically run it at about 500 cc's an hour and basically continuously lavage the abdominal cavity with this. We use a Barker vac, and because the white vac gets gummed up by the sugar. what that does is help just suction that out from the abdominal cavity. There's no one we don't use it in, and I think that was one of the important caveats that I said. If you actually look at the paper, and I describe how our technique in doing it that was in the paper in JACS, those patients, most of them had significant liver injuries or significant pancreas injuries. That's why we were leaving them open. Also, we had a lot of bleeding from pelvic fractures in that group as well. And we've never shown that you had to transfuse them anymore. So that doesn't cause any further bleeding. If they're packed, it's not like I'm going to float the packs off because I'm not really providing that large amount of resuscitation volume into their abdomen. They don't absorb the sugar. They may absorb it a little bit initially, but typically after about 2 to 4 hours, you don't see any changes in their blood glucose. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure if that's just related to surgery and trauma or what have you. But they don't long-term have any problems. You can use it in diabetics. That's a question someone has asked before. And it's simple. It's sugar, it's salt, it's water. So there's no real physiologic problems. No one's going to be allergic to it, or you have to worry about doing it. Now, we continue it until we get them closed. I do stop at about day 5 or 6 or 7 if I can't get them closed. But to be honest with you, as I think people have shown, we're getting the vast majority of everybody closed long before day 7, no matter what group we're using this in. So I do think it works well. I think it's a nice adjunct, and it doesn't really burn any bridges.
Yeah, I think it's a nice adjunct. I differ a little bit. I like to do it for the first 24 hours. And I think in patients that it makes a difference, it's impressive. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we sort of haven't seen much happen, or we're sort of done at 24 to 36 hours, we go ahead and start. So I think it's, again, it's another tool in your armamentarium to employ as you can.
Absolutely.
Center Mike? Okay. Or close, near Mike, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you all for your expertise today. Appreciate it. Eric Miller from Lynchburg, Virginia. Question for Dr. Berlew. In the sequential closure, I noticed that, and you probably explained this, I probably missed it, but
that's okay.
You started with the Barker type vac and then went to the white sponges. Was that because you were doing direct peritoneal resuscitation, or was there, do you have a kind of a standard way you address it at the index operation?
So we do not use a vac or an Abthera or whatever at our index operation. We do our adaptation of the Barker's vac pack, which is, we call it the 10-10 IABAN, which is just a, it literally is the number on the drape, 10-10 drape. It's just the sterile drape that you use to sort of drape off if you have a stoma inside that has the adhesive along one edge. We cut the adhesive off. We fenestrate that with a clean scalpel, little tiny fenestrations. Put that over all of the viscera. 2 JP drains just sit on top of that, sort of along the fascial edge, run off the top, and then an IABAN over top. And we do that for every single, whether it's general surgery or trauma. That is our end of that operation. Takes about, 60 seconds to get that all done, and the patient's out the door. Then, if we've placed, the majority of us will place an 18 French Blake round drain at the root of the mesentery in case we want to DPR those patients. Then that option exists. So we tend not to vac them early. I get a little nervous about high pressures worsening any type of perfusion issues in the abdomen or exacerbating ACS. As we all know, just because you have an open abdomen doesn't mean you can't develop abdominal compartment syndrome. So we just keep an eye on those patients and try. And if I'm going to leave them open, I don't want them to get ACS because that actually increases your morbidity. Right. So that's what we do for everybody.
And then you said you wanted to see the viscera.
I do.
You normally don't actually use the towels then.
I don't. Okay. When we first started, one of my pictures showed the old-fashioned Bogota bag. I was sort of the Bogota bag that we used to sew to the to the skin. When we first went to this 10-10 IABAN covering, we put a lap pad or a green towel, and then we started finding that we couldn't see the thing that was hiding underneath. And so some of our first pictures, the first couple of years of doing this, because it looks really tidy with that green towel there. And then you realize, well, but it may look tidy, but I'm missing the badness underneath. So we stopped doing that. And so that's why some of my pictures have the green towel. And I have to admit, some of my partners, I had a patient just like last week in the ICU that I, had an immediate stroke when I saw the 10-10 with the green towel. And my resident sitting here and is laughing at this, yes.
And then you went to the white sponges at the first reoperation?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Far? Far, Mike?
Sorry. Peng Chung Lau from Malaysia. I have a question for Dr. Berlew. I saw that picture where they had a patient where you had put a skin graft over it, and then the patient coughed, and the bubbles just eviscerated out. So I actually had a similar patient. So I just want to know what actually happened to that patient, because in my patient, unfortunately, that was 10 years ago. I was less experienced then. So my patient actually didn't make it, because after a series of lung infections from TPN, the patient didn't make it. But yeah, I just like to know how and what happened to the patient, because after that, I sort of did like something like a sequential abdominal closure for the rest of the patients after that.
Yeah, so we ended up basically allowing this, all that mucosa just ended up basically dying, and we ended up regranulating this bed and ended up doing a rotation flap of fascia down the road. It broke down slightly, but they ended up on TPN for about a year, and we rotated sites. He amazingly survived. I thought he was not going to survive because of, you know, but we actually got him through, and he does now have bowel continuity and an enormous hernia.
The patient actually ended with a short bowel since there are like multiple fistulas.
He's actually back in continuity, so we had to go back and because this is just multiple loops. Fortunately, there were just three major loops that ended up getting excised down the road. So we put stoma bags on all the openings that matured, and then we went back, reconnected everything, put that back in, and he has a hernia from that that now I'm not touching. I don't have the picture. The hernia is impressive. It's you know, out the lateral sidewall, but.
Thank you.
Thank you. Front mic.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Condell from Riverside, California. I'm only a couple years out of my training, and I'd like to ask the entire panel about a topic that has caused me many sleepless nights. What is the opinion of leaving an open abdomen for purulent or feculent peritonitis? The cases where I have left the abdomen open, usually within 24, 48 hours, I'm able to close the abdomen and not having to do much at the second operation, but in the cases where I've lavaged the abdomen with a couple liters of saline, left in drains and closed at the index operation, I've invariably gotten a post-operative intra-abdominal abscess. So I'd love everyone's opinion. Thank you.
I'll probably let John start this one.
About to get about five different opinions.
Yeah.
Terrific. Right. You can already tell who's going to be on what's end of the spectrum, but let's start with Dr. Harvin.
So there's no right answer, and that's why some surgeons in Calgary are trying to do a randomized controlled trial of this question. I tend to close because I think the rate of postoperative infection, regardless of whether you do a second laparotomy, is going to be about the same.
Dr. Smith.
So I agree with John. Surprisingly, I would close too in that case. For the most part, I agree. I think if you're going to wind up with an abscess, you're going to wind up with a deep space infection. It's going to occur whether you leave them open 24 hours or not. I don't think that one take back is going to make you not feel better about a abscess 7 days later. So I would close them if I think I can get them closed at the initial operation.
Dr. Ra.
If it makes you feel better, I use microcin irrigation if it's really gross and to wash them out with about 4 liters of fluid. Now, whether that helps or not, I don't know, but it makes me feel better. So sometimes I'll use that in a really purulent and dirty wound.
Dr. Cotton.
This is going to be obnoxious, but I'm going to agree with these two. I would do the same. I would wash the hell out of their abdomen, and I would close them. And we have IR in 2018, and they're pretty good. And they're going to get an abscess. Let them drain it later.
So I'll be the lone dissenter, you know. And this is the gray zone, right, of surgery. So I've had cases that it is a nightmare in there. And we actually DPR'd them and flushed them for 24 hours, and they didn't get an abscess. I don't think I would go much longer than 24. And in that patient, I might just not do the Barker's backpack, but do some type of keep the fascia towards the midline, because the last thing you want is not to be able to close it. And I do think my gestalt is that EGS cases at times are harder to close than trauma cases these days. And, you know, there's a nice consensus. If you look in the World Journal of Emergency Surgery, there's several recent consensus papers about use of the open abdomen for EGS cases. And there's not a lot of data behind it. It's a variable population when you look at those individual studies. There's a lot of different groups nationally that are trying to sort of talk about it. So I don't think there's a yes or a no answer, and I think it is a little bit more gestalt. I actually have left them open, so I don't think that's wrong either.
Thank you. Far mic.
Hi, Danielle Pignari from Hollywood, Florida. And I have a question about a similar question to hers, but about a patient that you're going to do damage control laparotomy, but it is grossly contaminated. And the role of antibiotics versus DPR, or if there's some overlap there. When you do DPR, do you also give them IV antibiotics, or do you ever do antibiotics in the irrigant?
So I don't use antibiotics in any of the irrigants, and what I'll say is, really, the data on feculent peritonitis and the length of antibiotics, there's a lot of studies, and none of them have shown really any significant differences in deep space tissue infections in patients if you give them long-term antibiotics. I would give them perioperative antibiotics unless I had an absolute source for the infection that I knew that I needed to treat, or they had some other cause for that. We didn't look at it, but I will anecdotally tell you I've not seen a significant difference in the ones that got antibiotics versus the ones that did not when they got DPR. I think the DPR from a practical standpoint is going to significantly lavage the abdominal cavity and remove contaminations. I also think it improves blood flow to the visceral cavity itself, which will help fight those infections. So I think you do have some physiologic benefit to it, but I'm doubtful that antibiotics would make a difference there.
I would agree. Dr. Singh.
Dr. Smith, I've been a big fan of the DPR for a while, and of course our hospital purchasing has just changed out our dialysate fluid. So our stock dialysate fluid went from an osmolality of 345 to 390 as our base is what I have access to right now. So is there a concern for that? And on that same line, is there any situation where you would do a different type or a higher or lower osmolality in that dialysate?
Yeah, if you look, the initial studies we did, we used mannitol solutions. In fact, some of the first stuff that we did actually used homemade mannitol solutions to make this. The osmolarity is the key. This gets into the Goldilocks zone. So we use Delflex, which is commercially available. It's cheap. It's glucose-based peritoneal dialysis fluid. It comes in 1.5, 2.5, and 4.25. The 1.25% solutions are actually for pediatrics. They use that for peritoneal dialysis in the open heart children. The 4.25 is what adults get for peritoneal dialysis, and the 2.5 is kind of this middle child that's around a little bit to monitor fluid balance. And that's actually where you see the best physiologic benefit. We use glucose because glucose causes itself, and the glucose degradation products cause vasodilatation in and around the viscera as a response to the glucose that they see. So you get some increase there. The osmolarity, you want to try and keep it around 400 or less. If you get much above that, you actually get peritoneal dialysis. And so particularly in trauma patients or these patients early on after surgery, you can get some pretty significant desiccation of the intravascular space by using the high osmolarity peritoneal dialysis solutions, which is what you want to fight against, that they're already having problems maintaining intravascular volume. I don't want to pull any more out of that as much as possible. And so that's why that 2.5% works. But there's nothing magic about that solution. I mean, we like that solution because it's cheap, it's easily available, and it works really well. I think the glucose is important, and I think the osmolarity is important. You could probably make it yourself. It's just sugar, salt, and water. So we've tried lots of different things. We use ferritin in lab animal ferritin solutions. Nothing worked as well as glucose, and that's why we use that solution.
Nice. Hey, quick question. Eric Mahoney from Tufts Medical Center. Could I just have each of your opinion on how aggressive you are in pushing diuresis and net negative by 72 hours? Are you pushing it to the point of needing pressors? How much? Where would you go? So just what's your old gestalt?
I will say that we don't generally use diuretics in that first period, in the early period, with the exception of hypertonic saline. Hypertonic saline, at least in our experience, causes quite a decent diuresis. I will tell you, over the last three or four years, Dr. Harvin and I have talked, and I think we're losing the bang for the buck at our facility because we give so little crystalloid now. Even the pictures from his where we were giving, you know, 5 versus 7, it's now down to, you know, raising eyebrows if they get more than a liter and a half in the operating room, and if they're over 3 liters in the first 24 hours. So I don't think we get that bang for the buck. When we do start to diurese them and try to run them net negative about 48 to 72 to start. A lot of us will use furosemide and albumin, 25% albumin as a diuretic, but that's usually in our more older population where we think we pushed them over the limit. In our young, we let them auto diurese. Jen?
We don't actively diurese our patients either. We just limit the amount of fluid and then give blood more frequently. And then we also use the Whitman patch for our patient population to keep the fascia from retracting back. And we really use the wound vacs early as well.
Yeah, I don't push diuresis either in those patients. If they're requiring significant fluid volumes at 48 and 72 hours, I always say that's a sign that something else is going on that you're missing. I mean, really, if you get the resuscitation strategy right and you really start to pull them out, really by about 24 to 48 hours, you should be almost eumolivic on your volume status. And if you've not given them or loaded them with the first 24 hours, the patients will give that fluid up and will autodiurese when they're well. If they're not, again, then you just have to start looking at what else is going on because something is missing from this equation.
Yeah, I don't diurese in the early stages either. I aim for euvolemia, not hypovolemia, not hypervolemia, certainly, just euvolemia.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's just to be aware of where you stand day to day, and maybe that's the goal of being cognizant. We will diurese patients, and I'm not sure that our patients in the first 24 hours really only get 1 or 2 liters of crystalloid. My take on crystalloid is that it's a drug like every other drug that we give, and there are times that it's very appropriate to give a liter of crystalloid versus a blood product if someone's not bleeding and their TEG is normalized and we think that they've received enough, and that you have to balance all of those factors. And so for us, in looking at their volume status, no, I don't want them on pressors, much like if I don't give them crystalloid, I don't want them to end up on dialysis either because we box their kidneys. So I think it's all of it is being judicious, and you don't want them markedly positive if they will tolerate some diuretic. You know, I typically do a low-dose Lasix strip so you can calculate them, you know, hour to hour versus a big slug of 40 of Lasix. So, again, everything in moderation is probably the best way to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you all the panel for your wonderful talks. Thank you for the audience for your questions and your presence. Thank you.